What is... Dax, are you...
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker? On all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all. So we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge! Trucks up 3.9%!
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
Hey, it's Gemma Spegg, host of the Open Mind original podcast, Mantra. Every Monday, I'll bring you a new mantra, a simple yet powerful phrase to help you clear your mind and stay grounded amidst the chaos. I'll also share some personal stories, journal prompts, and a weekly challenge to bring each mantra to life. Follow and listen to Mantra, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with Open Mind Studios, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
I wish Joe Biden all the best, but the fact is he has left us dumpster fire, not just at the border, but also with the economy. First of all, we know that prices are way too high for many Americans. We have to work every single day to stabilize prices for American families. But Shannon, everything that he's bragging about ignores the fact that he has added trillions and trillions of dollars to the federal debt during a time of peace. He has left us with bond yields, meaning how are we going to finance that debt? We have to sell Treasury bonds. And the Treasury bonds have gotten more expensive because of Joe Biden's policies. So you go issue after issue. Oil prices are now shooting through the roof in the final 2 months of Joe Biden's administration, in part because of decisions that Joe Biden has made over the last few weeks. He actually hasn't left the American people in good economic condition. That's why they made Donald J. Trump the president-elect of the United States. So we've got a lot of work to do. I remain fundamentally, and you know this, Shannon, I'll always be an optimist about our country, but I think that optimism has to start with a bit of realism. And the real truth is that Joe Biden has left us a dumpster fire. Donald Trump is going to have to put it out, but he's good at doing that.
A dumpster fire that is being left for Donald Trump to put out. And we've got just the guy to walk us through how that might be possible. Steve Moore joins us once again, the distinguished fellow in economics at the Heritage Foundation and a Trump economic advisor, as well as his authorship of the book, The Trump Economic Miracle and the Plan to Unleash Prosperity Again. Steve, welcome back to the show. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Annie. Great to be. By the way, I missed the very first part of, who was that?
J.D. Vance. Was vice president-elect.
Oh, yeah. He's exactly right. In fact, I've been saying the same thing that, you know, I use the term, you know, that Trump's going to need a giant pooper scooper to clean up the mess.
That might honestly be a better analogy than dumpster fire right now as we watch LA.
So, so there's a lot of work to be done, and I'm optimistic about the fact that we're going to turn things around. But, you know, I think it's going to take a little longer than I thought, because it's true that, you know, everything Biden's done just the last couple of weeks, you know, taking all those millions of acres off land for development, you know, he's spending every penny he can get his hands on. It's almost like he's trying to make the problems worse.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he wants to mess it up as much as he can before Trump gets in there to make it difficult for him to have success. So as an advisor of his, how is he going to bob and weave through all of these obstacles Biden is putting in front of him?
Well, we've got to get going. We got to hit the ground running on day one. And he will. You know, by the way, he's not even going to, as soon as he takes the oath of office. Are you coming, Annie? Are you coming to D.C.?
Oh, my gosh. I wish I were. I'll be broadcasting live on Martin Luther King Day here. We're going to cover it all wall to wall. So.
Okay. Well, it's going to be exciting. By the way, I'll come on the show because we do always every Monday about this time. We're going to have about 250 people at the Hay Adams Hotel, which is right across from the White House, and so it's going to be very noisy in there, but I'll come out.
we'll take you. Brad's writing notes down right now.
Okay, that's great. Anyway, so it's you got to hit the ground running. What the plan is that Trump is going to take he's going to be sworn in on the Capitol steps sometime around noon to 1 o'clock, right about the time you come on the air. Mm-hmm. And then normally then that they have a parade, you know, down Pennsylvania Avenue, the very famous parade. But Trump is going to go into the Capitol as soon as he's sworn in. He's going to start signing these executive orders.
That's
to
great.
Undo all the damage. And then they'll have the parade. That, in other words, he cannot wait to start reversing these crazy policies that Biden put in place. But we got to get the tax bill done. We cannot wait. You know, my line is we got to do this in the first 150 days, because I want to remind your listeners, if we do not get this done, the average person and family that's listening to the show is going to lose $3,000. They're going to pay a higher tax. In other words, doing nothing is not an option. We have to get this this passed right away. And then we're going to do the energy development. And then, of course, you saw what happened with that. Was it the Lincoln-Riley bill? You know, passed like with 80 votes in the Senate. This is so cruel, so inhumane to, you know, round up the criminal aliens.
Yes.
And it turns out when we put it to a vote, guess what? Everybody's, you know, aboard this agenda because it makes sense.
Yeah. I want to ask you about your observations here. They got the speaker passed, so Mike Johnson's back in the speakership. Mar-a-Lago has been teaming with Republican leadership from the House of Representatives. They're pushing through this reconciliation bill. I've heard about big, beautiful bills, or maybe two would be fine. What's your confidence right now in the House GOP's job and their ability to get their job done with Donald Trump's leadership?
Well, Congress is very difficult to ever estimate what they're going to do. But I think we will get this tax bill done. I'm going to make a prediction to you that we get a bill signed into law by Memorial Day.
Okay.
And that would be like the first 150 days. And that's because it can't wait. The longer you wait, the law, you know, I mentioned this last week on your show. Trump is more popular today than ever.
Yeah.
He's ever been. And he's got a huge amount of political capital. He's got the public behind him. He's got to go, 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 go. You know, don't waste this. Don't waste the moment. Go. It's just like, you know, when FDR came in, you know, it's just a blizzard of activity in the 1933. Well, now we got to have Trump come in and just change the direction of our country, because J.D. Vance is right. I mean, this is a mess.
Yeah. We're speaking with Steve Moore right now. He's a Trump economic advisor and a distinguished fellow in economics at the Heritage Foundation. I want to ask you a little bit about the situation in California. And, you know, once they get these fires completely under control, and we pray sincerely and deeply that that happens very, very soon, I've been thinking about the blue state, the navy blue state that California is, and the government regulation that's going to exist between where these people are now and where they will need to be if they choose to rebuild in California. We're going to get to see up front how much government is willing to stay in the way or get out of the way for recovery here. I'm just wondering what your observations have been of the devastation and the fires in California and what's going to have to happen next to get them back in line.
Look, what's happened in California is, I would almost say, criminally negligent. I mean, this shows you what happens when you have progressive, out-of-touch politicians, including Governor Gavin Newsom. Can you believe Gavin Newsom is considered a front-runner to be the Democratic nominee for 2028? I mean, come on. What they have done in California has done so much damage. Not just to property, but obviously lives that have been lost, and also the fact that it's going to cost, I've heard estimates of over $100 billion to rebuild what has been lost to these fires. Millions of trees. You know, trees, I thought environmentalists were in favor of trees,
yeah.
But we, you know, I kind of laugh about it. But my point is that, you know, one of the leading causes of carbon and greenhouse gases into the atmosphere are forest fires. You know, these forest fires have caused more carbon to go into the atmosphere and more carcinogens than every car in the whole state of California. So my point is, if they had spent one-tenth as much money in California worrying about forest fires rather than worrying about climate change, this would not have happened. And tell me this, you can tell I'm angry about it, because I am.
Yeah.
Tell me how you can have forest fires and run out of water when you're 3 miles away from an ocean.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, there's got to be a desalination plan that gets that water.
You don't even have to desalinate the water. I mean, to put out a fire.
Yeah.
I mean, it is unbelievable to me that that these kinds of things happen, and that the irony is that it's not just bad for the economy; it's bad for the environment. You know, the worst thing to breathe is the smoke. That gets in your lungs. It can do permanent damage.
Yeah, it's there's.
I mean, I have a son who lived in Los Angeles. He had to move out. You know, he's out of there. You know, because you can't breathe the air there.
Oh man. Well, prayers for fast and just full recovery for these people. But the death toll keeps going up, and I'm just watching the government at all levels, which is very, very left leaning, hand off responsibility one way or the other.
They're incompetent. They're incompetent. The fact is, this was one of the great dangers. Everyone knew that this was a powder keg. And the state, you turn on the fire hydrants and the water doesn't come out?
It's outrageous.
It is.
Yeah. Well, Steve, I think that the next time, if you are available next Monday, that we speak, Donald Trump
Trump will be president of the United States.
I'm excited to be able to say that, and we will pray for that moment and hit the ground running and get this country back to where it's supposed to be. Steve, thank you for being with us.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Steve Moore, a distinguished fellow in economics at the Heritage Foundation, a Trump economic advisor, in his book, The Trump Economic Miracle and the Plan to Unleash Prosperity Again, starts Monday. And nice to see that he's willing to come on the show next Monday. Hopefully he follows through on that. These people who we have connections with, they're all such great people, and they make time for you because they care about you and they want to talk to you. And it's going to be a busy day Monday, but the excitement is real. The energy is real. And we'll get him back on here. I'll talk a little bit about that. Next Monday is Martin Luther King Day. It's traditionally a holiday for us, so we would normally be off that day. But the Annie Fry Show knew that we would be on the air while all of the things were happening. We're going to see, as you listen to Steve Moore say, he's going to swear in, and then he's going to go into the Capitol and start signing EOs. We're going to have all of that covered for you live here, of course. It's going to be a fun opportunity to spend time together, God willing. I mean, I remember when we were on the air for January 6, 2021, and you thought, okay, let's go see how this constitutional process plays out, questioning the results of an election, and little did we know what we would end up being able to cover during that historic day. This will be a little bit different, we pray, and we are going to be here on the holiday celebrating with you, so please add us to your list of things to do as we watch the president be sworn in 1 week from today. It's really crazy that this is happening.
It's very similar to opening day, you know, for the Cardinals to me. When you watch all the pomp and circumstance, it's fun. You know, you're just kind of enjoying watching a tradition and all the things that go along with it. And you're excited about what could happen.
Yeah.
But then it's once the baseball starts that you're like, all right, here we go. And that stuff's happening that day.
Yeah. Very, very impactfully. And I can't help but, this is the first time in my lifetime, certainly as a broadcaster, but as somebody who's been paying attention, I would say pretty sincerely to politics and to the consequences of elections and the importance of voting and all of that. Since I was a junior in high school, I've been paying close attention to it. This is the first time that I'm watching a president be inaugurated and get to work with such a fresh understanding and feeling of what it was like to be on the other side of watching the person who you did not want to get in there. And that's a real emotion. A lot of people are going to be feeling that day. I mean, if we're looking here at what's taking place and knowing that there are people who are still very sad that Donald Trump won. I'm also going to say, I don't know a lot of people in my life who felt like their life fell apart after November 5th.
No, I don't either.
I don't think that they voted for Trump.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of, and our guests said this, I think Steve Moore said this within the last couple of weeks, that he knows a lot of people, and obviously he knows a lot of Washington people.
Yeah.
And his Washington friends who voted for Harris were like, well, okay, Trump did a few things. Let's see what he can do.
I think Steve Moore used the word relieved. People who supported Kamala Harris were relieved that Trump won.
That's an interesting place to be.
Let's take a quick break. Andy McCarthy on the Andy Fry Show. When we come back, we're going to talk about the aftermath of the sentencing of Donald Trump. Also, President Biden is going to give a foreign policy speech here soon. We're going to talk to Andy McCarthy next and respect the booking that we had with him. But we are watching Antony Blinken, who is the current Secretary of State, speaking in front of a podium. I would presume that what is taking place here right now is some ceremonial goodbyes maybe that are happening, but President Biden should be speaking, and we will watch that and monitor and probably bring you some highlights after we get done speaking to Andy McCarthy. One of those questions we had from one of the listeners who called in the 12 o'clock hour about our YouTube live chat poll, should the Trump inauguration go on as traditionally planned? I think it was caller Brandon, maybe, that asked, so if Trump's a felon and there are certain countries that felons can't travel to, .. Well, we'll add that to the list of questions. We'll ask Andy McCarthy next on the Andy Fry Show. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Andy Fry Show. We're going to connect here in a minute with Andy McCarthy. But before we do, President Biden, 1 week from stepping down while Donald Trump comes in and gets inaugurated, he'll be president at this time next week. He is giving one final foreign policy speech from the State Department. We are going, well, let's put this off. Let's pause the State Department speech. We'll get back to that because I think he's doing some formalities here. The Antony Blinken conversation was kind of some backpacking. This is what they're going to do. It is what it is. But I want to set up here. Can we go to Biden?
Yeah.
Every time I say let's go to Biden, Andy McCarthy calls us back.
Ding dong, ding dong, ding dong, ding dong. It's just blinking lights everywhere.
Yeah.
It's fun to be in a studio, ladies and gentlemen.
There's so much going on here. I'm going to play this clip here from Charlemagne talking about the Trump sentencing from last week.
What a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what a waste of time. Pure political theater. They was never, ever going to convict the former our sitting president of nothing. And what was even more ridiculous was watching, liberals celebrate this. Like, this is not a win. Who cares if you can call him a convicted felon when you still got to call him president for the next 4 years? Who cares?
So Charlemagne is saying, talking about the sentencing and saying it was a profound waste of time. We do have the convicted 34 felonies in that Alvin Bragg case and now a sentencing from this past week. And you have to ask yourself, what for? What was all this for when the sentencing comes down? And it's like, basically, thank you for your time. You're free to go. Let's ask our friend Andy McCarthy, contributing editor at National Review, a Fox News contributor, host of The McCarthy Report. Andy, thank you for the time today. It's good to have you back.
Annie, it's my pleasure. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. 1 week from this moment right now, we will have a President Trump. But last Friday, we have convicted felon Trump. We've talked to you many times about the sentencing being a requirement to be referred to as a convicted felon. What's your reaction to that sentencing this past week?
Well, I mean, in the end, it's much ado about nothing because they spent the whole campaign calling him a convicted felon. I understand. And probably because I was a prosecutor for a long time, and also because, like any other person who gets to be, you know, a certain age, if you've lived your whole life without a criminal conviction, that's something you're proud of and you want to maintain. So I certainly understand why, personally, at the age of 78, President Trump didn't want to be branded a convicted felon in a formal official way. But if, you know, that's his personal feeling about it, which I have a lot of sympathy for. But in the greater scheme of things, it really doesn't seem to make much difference because they called him a convicted felon throughout the campaign and he won.
Yeah.
And in the end, this thing was not a one-off. This case was part of a crusade against him that was coordinated among Democrats, Democratic political operatives, and Democratic prosecutors. So I don't think you can look at it as one isolated thing and say, what was the point? Because it was all part of one big assault on him. But the point, the major fallout of it is it failed. He's going to become president. And the small thing that I guess matters is, as you just pointed out, Annie, the sentencing is the thing he had to go through to end the case in the lower court. And he will, I think he will only be a convicted felon until he gets appellate review, at which point this case will get thrown out. So from his standpoint, as long as his lawyers can go about challenging the case on appeal, then the sooner they get on with it, the better.
So Andy McCarthy speaking with us right now. My understanding is you're kind of saying there that you can't appeal until the sentencing is complete.
Right.
So now President Trump is in he's one step closer to exonerating himself by going through that appeal process. Is he going to be treated like any other citizen through the appeal process? He's the president. Does it get expedited? What happens next?
Well, you know, I think people are down and there's a good reason to be suspicious on New York's court system. But I would say, you know, having been a New Yorker, you know, born and bred and observed that system for a long time, even though I was a federal prosecutor and spent my career in the federal system, I had to interact with the state system in criminal cases and even civil cases a lot of times. The quality of justice tends to get better as you go up the chain in the system. You just get better appointments, generally speaking, in the appellate level. And then, of course, the Court of Appeals is the highest court in the state. I forget how many they have, seven judges. But so I do think he'll do okay in the New York system. And I would just point out to people who poo-poo it, the appellate division in the civil case that Trump had that was brought by the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, the appellate division reversed Judge Engoron, who was the crazy judge who presided over that case, a number of times. And they were very hostile to the state at the oral argument. We don't know what's going to happen yet, but I would bet that when we get the decision on the civil case, the whole case may get thrown out, and at the very least, that huge award that Engoron ordered against Trump is going to be, I think, substantially discounted. So, and the other thing I point out to people is the only in New York, I would say, somebody who was politically more of a hot button, or at least on a par with Trump, as far as that's concerned, is Harvey Weinstein. Mm. I mean, that was one of the biggest scandals. It's a scandal that has a name after it, right? The whole Me Too thing that went on for years. I would just point out that last year, the Court of Appeals in New York threw out Harvey Weinstein's conviction because he didn't get a fair trial. So if they were just going to do the political thing, they would have rubber stamped that. And instead, what they did was they reversed it. So yeah. I have hope that as you go up the chain, you're going to get better results. Plus, the New York courts know the Supreme Court may review what they do, which, you know, when you know someone's going to check your homework, you usually do a better job.
I keep telling my son that.
How's that working out for you?
He's a freshman in high school. We learned a lot of lessons in the first semester. We'll put it that way.
Yep.
He did
yep.
okay.
Yep.
Andy McCarthy speaking with us right now. I want to take this down to like the 100 level course of the legal system, even before the 101. Because we hear about these judges and you're like, good grief, how can they be as political as they are? Like, what retribution do voters have or do people who might find themselves in these courtrooms have? And also, when we go through elections, the question I get the most from people is like, Annie, tell me about the judges that are on my ballot, like voting to retain and so on and so forth. Like a Mershon and Engoron, all of these people, we can go down to Georgia and talk about some of the system down there as well. Are any of these people, these names that American voters and taxpayers have come to know in New York or throughout the course of the system, are these people accountable to the voters or are they appointed to their positions to where some other action, maybe from a state legislature, would have to take place to remove them?
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things that you said in teeing up that question is probably the most important thing of all, which is the voting part of it. In the federal system, judges are appointed, right? So they don't face the voters. They don't get elected. They have to be vetted by the Senate, and that at least puts them through a process where it's expected that they're going to represent that they will not take politics into account when they're exercising their authority. Now, you can argue that, you know, they say whatever they need to say to get confirmed, and then they do what they do once they get on the bench. But at least it shows that there's an expectation there that, you know, the senators ask the questions and the appointees answer them in a way that tells everybody taking politics into account is a bad thing, which is why I like an appointed system a lot better than an elected system for judges for that reason. I think we get to at least examine them, and we get a shot at knocking them out if they're, if they have radical backgrounds. The problem with electoral systems where the judges get elected rather than appointed is that politics is basic to the mix, right? I mean, right. They actually get elected to their positions, which at least creates an appearance that they're expected to make their ruling something that would be appealing to the voters, at least as they see that. Whereas a judge's job, the reason judges are insulated from politics in the federal system is we want judges to be able to make the unpopular decision if it's the right legal one. And if you're getting unpopular decisions that are the right legal one, then Congress has a chance to change the law, to meet what the public's expectations are. But we don't want judges taking politics into account. It's hard to make them do that in a system that's political to begin with. And then the other problem, Annie, is where this has really become problematic in all the places that you mentioned, and your city of St. Louis as well, but, Atlanta, New York, et cetera, these are one-party jurisdictions. So, yes, in a sense, these judges answer to the voters because they're on the ballot, but if there's no Republican Party to speak of, then the election's kind of a sham, right? Because mm-hmm. they're not really running. Once the Democrats pick them and put them on the ballot, they're going to be elected. And the Democrats tend to pick, they don't pick Antonin Scalia's, right? They what they do is they have, you have these club party lawyers who do stuff for the party for 15 or 20 years. And the big plum they get at the end is they get to be on the bench and wear a black robe and everything's very cute.
Yeah.
But it's not really, they may come away and say that, they're responsible to the voters, but I think they're really responsible to the party because they don't have any practical opposition as far as the voters are concerned.
Yeah. I think that the Americans, certainly Trump supporters, have learned a lot about the justice system in the last couple years and maybe can use that knowledge or at least the inquiry of how does this work to put us in a better position to make better decisions when it comes to who's sitting on those benches and sending the people to the Senate or to the state legislatures, those individuals who oversee these appointments. I wanted to ask you one more question before we let you go. We're speaking with Annie McCarthy. We're very grateful for your time today. I wanted to give you an opportunity to comment on Jack Smith, who resigned from as Trump's case is winded down and he's in the position that he's in right now, which is pretty much out the door anyway. Your thoughts on Jack Smith, the reports that could potentially be released regarding Donald Trump and the cases that he's faced a week out of his inauguration?
Yeah, well, so as far as the reports are concerned, I'll deal with the last thing that you said at the end, because I think that's the easiest thing to deal with. What difference does it make at this point? 3 weeks before the election, he filed a public submission in the January 6th case that was 2,000 pages long that laid out his whole case. So what more is he going to say in a final report that he hasn't already said there? And as far as the Florida case is concerned, he indicted that twice. He litigated it for over 2 years. Everybody understands what his case was and why he made the charging decisions that he made, which is why special counsels get to file a report. Most normal prosecutors don't get to file a report. When I was a prosecutor in New York, if I decided that we didn't have a case against someone, I would have a confidential conversation with my chain of command and say, I don't think we should bring this case. And if they agreed with me, we would drop it, but we wouldn't go public with the evidence because you're not supposed to do that in the Justice Department. With special counsels, they make a rule that they can file a report at the end. The rule says it's supposed to be a confidential report, but because you're dealing with public officials and there's clamor from Congress and from the media, it's become pretty routine that these things get released. I think there's a big difference between a special counsel investigation where the special counsel actually filed charges and one where he didn't. You know, when the special counsel doesn't file charges, then you could say, okay, we have a public official who was investigated for potential criminality. This is the only way we're ever going to find out what happened here. Give us a report. And then the attorney general can decide how much of it should be public, consistent, and it's never consistent, with the Justice Department's usual rules that you don't publicize evidence against people that you don't charge. But it just seems to me when it's someone like Jack Smith, who has filed numerous indictments and then filed numerous public court submissions explaining why he brought the charges and what his theory is and who his evidence, you know, whose witnesses are and all that stuff. What do we need a report from him for? You know, he laid all that stuff out already. And I don't think, you know, everything we saw from Jack Smith is that I don't think he's a stupid guy at all, but I do think he's a zealot. And a zealot doesn't leave anything on the cutting room floor. Yeah. You know, I think if Jack Smith thought he had a crime, he put it in the indictments. So what are we going to learn from, you know, the reason he couldn't get to trial in Florida, and maybe the whole history of this would have been different, is because he overcharged the case. Like, he threw everything, including the kitchen sink, into the indictment. So what are we going to learn from his special, you know, from his final report that we don't already know?
Mm. Well, if he was anything, he was certainly useful for an amount of time.
He was.
Yeah. I mean, if he were successful, I think that it wouldn't be Donald Trump swearing the oath of office next week. I think that's kind of what we all assume that this was supposed to be, and it didn't happen. So, but he gave it his best, I suppose.
He underestimated the difficulty of prosecuting a president. And as a result, the thing he really didn't anticipate was the immunity ruling. And the real, you know, everybody says Smith did all this stuff and he comes away with nothing. And that, in the end, that's true. But I don't think it does justice to the way this played out, because the most important thing that happened in the 2 years of lawfare was the Supreme Court. First, the appeals process of the immunity froze everything for 7 months so that Smith couldn't do anything. He couldn't get those cases to trial. And then at the end, the Supreme Court gave sweeping immunity to presidents, which made it practically impossible for Smith to do anything. So, yes, you know, he's a complete failure in the end. But, you know, the way this played out, he probably, the indictments helped Trump get nominated. You know, they completely stopped the momentum of every other Republican in the field, including DeSantis, who, you know, started out pretty well, at least in the polls. And then I think the Democrats thought they were going to get phase two of lawfare, where they were going to get these cases to trial and really bury Trump. And it just didn't happen.
Yeah, it's been something to take in. And I guess the next time you and I talk, we will have a new president. It's just kind of an amazing roller coaster ride arc that we've been on. And your expertise has been so valuable to our audience. Andy McCarthy, thank you for being with us today, and Happy New Year to you as well.
Thank you so much, Annie. Appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye. Andy McCarthy, contributing editor at the National Review, Fox News contributor, of course, host of The McCarthy Report. Check out his podcast. A very knowledgeable guy there. And I will also add, he's not like some Trump sycophant. So I know a lot of people who probably don't listen to the show all the time just think that we're here to praise Trump. And we are certainly here to praise Trump on the praiseworthy things of Donald Trump. But honest and fairness and objectivity, those are important, too. And we are so grateful for Andy McCarthy's time each time he's willing to come share his expertise with us. All right. If I told you we weren't going to listen to Biden's speech when we come back, would you be more likely to listen? Or if I told you we were, that should be the break, the poll for the break. He's talking from... He's giving his last foreign policy speech. They say it's his last. God willing, it's his last, because if he has to come back and give another one between now and then, I'm worried about what that might be. It seems as though, I don't know how much you've been listening to it right now, it's kind of a victory lap of sorts. These are all the things we've done.
More or less. Gone on quite a bit. Lots of applause. At the very beginning was a lot of pomp and circumstance. You know,
sure.
Blinken came out and was like, here's Joe Biden, and he did a great job. And everybody's like, yeah.
People do those things.
He stood there with the teleprompter in front of his face.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it yet, the screenshot of Antony Blinken, and I would be curious to look at other networks to see if they had the same shot, because if there's multiple cameras in that room, maybe Fox did that on purpose. I don't know. Antony Blinken standing behind the podium with the presidential seal on, getting ready to invite Joe Biden to take over and deliver this speech. And in the shot, you see Antony Blinken clear as day in front of this podium, and Joe Biden is standing directly behind the teleprompter that's up there. And it's just, you know, a skinny pole that goes up to this like rectangular shape, clear plastic looking thing, rectangular plastic looking thing. And it's just completely covering Joe Biden's face. Joe Biden's head was a teleprompter. It's Ryan was in here. He goes, this is an SNL skit in the making. We'll maybe dip in on the break here and see what we can see and bring that to you if there are highlights. If it's just a U.S. adversaries are weaker today. Lies detected. We'll check it out for you. Maybe we'll filter it. Maybe we won't. But more Annie Fry Show right around the corner. YouTube live chat poll. Should the Trump inauguration go on as traditionally planned? Yes or no? We want to know what you think. Join us on the Annie Fry YouTube. New Year's resolutions. Do you have any? Maybe it should be to join us on the YouTube. There, I made one for you. And if you come join us on the YouTube, you can say that you did it. You completed your New Year's resolution. You could be done for the year. How about that? Go to youtube.com/@AnnieFry. You'll see that we're broadcasting live there right now. And the poll is located in the comment section, the live chat portion of that YouTube broadcast. And you can tell us if you think it should go on as planned. Yes or no? We got 211 votes in halfway through the show. And it's kind of a leaning heavily on one side or the other. So you can tell us what you think. We'll be back. And Ryan Wiggins back in studio with us. The song from the Biden goodbye party, We Found Love in a Hopeless Place. That's not real.
This is what he's been walking into, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Into and out of press conferences. All of his press conferences, all of his many.
Joe, can you be like, what's my walk-up song for this press conference? Maybe they wouldn't give it to him. That's why he quit doing them.
That's why he played his own.
It's in his head. He did hold up Despacito,
yes,
the
exactly.
One he was talking to the Latino people. Oh my God.
Oh my God.
That's the best.
I have done my fair share of speaking engagements where people show up to hear what I have to say. It's a great honor to do that. And I'm just thinking of being invited to like an ethnically cultural place and being like, Despacito, am I right? If I did that.
And they tell you no, and you're like, okay, I'm going to play it anyway on my phone.
I'm like, the people will love it. They'll understand it. If I did that, it would make national news and I would be unemployed. As I should be. My goodness. Let's dip into. Do you have that queued up to, like, right when he was talking about the hostage situation and stuff?
He's talking about passing off to the Trump administration.
Okay. Well, we've been watching in studio here President Biden deliver what is being referred to as his last foreign policy speech. We're getting into the lasts, folks. It's like senior year. Everybody's parting ways. It's kind of sad, but we're also kind of happy.
Love you. Don't change.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you imagine?
I'm signing your crack.
Oh, man. Yearbook.
Yep. Yeah.
This is, I can't segue better into President Biden speaking. Just do it. Do the thing. You know the thing. Play.
There are serious challenges the United States must continue to deal with. In Ukraine, in the Middle East, in the Indo-Pacific. Must keep the pressure on the Houthis, who are attacking ships in the Red Sea, launching missiles at Israel, and firing at American forces. Must deter North Korea as they rattle their saber and draw closer to Russia. And new challenges will certainly emerge in the months and years ahead. But even so, it's clear, my administration is leaving the next administration with a very strong hand to play. And we're leaving them in America with more friends and stronger alliances, whose adversaries are weaker and under pressure. And America, that once again is leading, uniting countries, setting the agenda, bringing others together behind our plans and visions. In America, which is no longer at war, which has made historic investments in American workers, American energies, American factories, generating the strongest economy in the world, which is now in a much better position to win the future against any competitor. These wins are not partisan. They're American. They benefit all Americans and reflect America's endless capacity for leadership and reinvention. Look, folks, the United States should take full advantage of our diplomatic and geopolitical opportunities we've created to keep bringing countries together to deal with challenges posed by China, to make sure Putin's war ends in a just and lasting peace for Ukraine, and to capitalize on a new moment for a more stable, integrated Middle East. To do that, the next administration must make sure the fall of Assad does not lead to the resurgence of ISIS in Syria and across the region. It must carry forward the commitment that America will never, never allow Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon. And on the war between Israel and Hamas, we're on the brink of a proposal that I laid out in detail months ago, finally coming to fruition. I have learned in many years of public service to never, 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 ever give up. So I spoke to Prime Minister of Israel yesterday. I spoke to Emir Qatar today. I look forward to speaking with President Sisi soon. We're pressing hard to close this. The deal we have structured would free the hostages, halt the fighting, provide security to Israel, and allow us to significantly surge humanitarian assistance to the Palestinians who've suffered terribly in this war that Hamas started. They've been through hell. So many innocent people have been killed. So many communities have been destroyed. The Palestinian people deserve peace and the right to determine their own futures. Israel deserves peace and real security. And the hostages and their families deserve to be reunited. And so we're working urgently to close this deal. And as we deal with media challenges, in my view, we have to look to the...
Well, that's President Biden speaking right there, and he's giving his final foreign policy speech, and it's, I guess, a culmination of how he views it at this point in time. But I will remind you, Donald Trump repeatedly has, speaking about the hostages that he was just talking about there, he has repeatedly said they need to be released before he's sworn into office. Otherwise, there will be all hell to pay. Joe Biden giving that speech, and a lot of people glad handing after he was done and he's walking out now. So if we get 12,000 YouTube subscribers before we come back, we'll air the rest of that speech.
People are unsubscribing.
Wait. Unless we get 12,000 subscribers.
Yeah, there you go.
Now I got it right. Sorry about that. Only a week left, folks. Only a week left. We'll be right back.